This is an Alien UFO Podcast classic episode, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. There are a number of episodes that I released on the podcast a few years ago, and they are full of great information, and I thought it would be a good idea to share them for listeners who may have missed them the first time around. This episode dates back to 2022. This week I'm talking to Greg Lawson about his book, Roswell, The After Action Report. Greg has travelled to over 40 countries, visiting some of Earth's strangest sites and conducting his own investigation of their paranormal histories. Greg is a 30-year law enforcement officer, professional investigator, police academy instructor, college educator, and former expert witness for investigative procedures. He also researches and investigates human paranormal experience and locations known for spiritual or unusual activity. Greg is also a 10-year military veteran with the US Army, Navy and Air Force, and is currently a street patrol lieutenant in Central Texas. Hi Greg, thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
So glad to be here, man. Thanks for asking me.
Your book is called Roswell, The After Action Report, and it's a fascinating book, and I got tons of questions for you. But basically, first of all, what is an after action report?
That's what a lot of people ask me. So in the military, I make a joke and say I have Armed Forces Attention Deficit Disorder. I was enlisted in the military, and I did Army, Navy, and Air Force. And people are like, yeah, you can do that? I'm like, yeah, they don't care as long as you pass the test and, you know, you volunteer and sign the contract. I don't care. So in the military, in certain types of action, if it's combat action or if it's a training scenario, the idea behind, let's say, a training scenario is to get your guys out there, get them some experience because they've already gone through school and they've done some training and they got a theory of how things should work. But as soon as, as soon as the start gun goes, your plan goes all to shit and you got to figure out, how you're going to fix all the problems that you have. So an after action report is a debriefing of that after you complete your exercise, whatever it is, and you come back into garrison and you're cleaning things up and everything. You do a debriefing, and in that debriefing, you come up with all the lessons learned of what you just went through, because there's an idea of how you wanted to do it, step one through step 10, let's say. And you realize that during step three, you couldn't do step four because something moved or you lost an asset or whatever it is. So you have to be able to adjust off of that. And so that's where the after action report comes in, is it identifies lessons learned in the action that you just went through, and you then try to do it better next time. So hence Roswell, the after action report. I've sat back and watched a whole bunch of different investigators go through this thing, and I've stood on the backs of great men like Don Schmidt and Tom Carey and Kevin Randall and Stanton Freeman and all those guys that did the real work. And then I sit back like like in a debriefing and kind of listened to what they all had to say, and then identified the weaknesses in our or in their processes, I guess. And anybody can do that. You know, I have 30 plus years in law enforcement. I'm currently a lieutenant at a pretty large agency in Texas. And so I've been in charge of a lot of big investigations, been in charge of a lot of specialized units. And it's real easy to be in my position and to sit back and tell you what you should have done. You know, it's that Monday morning quarterback thing. And I'm not saying it to these guys as, I'm not chastising them in their processes, but I am able to look back at that now and identify things that they wouldn't normally have known. Most of these guys were not professional investigators. Stanton Freeman was could be considered a professional researcher, as a nuclear physicist, he would be considered a professional researcher, but that doesn't make you an expert at interrogation or, forensic examination. It just doesn't. And when you haven't worked in that kind of field, and you haven't had to deal with humans and their perception of their experience and their interpretation of evidence, you just kind of bite on every hook that's laid out there. You go down every rabbit trail that's presented to you, and sometimes we get lost in the weeds. So that is a really long explanation of what I did in this book, but that's it.
Yeah, that's great, because in your role in the police, and you train people, I believe, in interrogation techniques, and so you can look at what the witnesses in Roswell said originally and use your sort of interrogation skills to see, you know, if there's a breakdown in what they've said in different places and if it becomes suspect. And also you spot where perhaps questions should have been asked and they weren't asked, and the investigators let themselves down a little bit.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Especially, I'm especially critical of the 1994 investigation that the Air Force conducted, for the simple fact that I know investigators of the Office of Special Investigations. I know NIS officers, and I know the level of arrogance that is within that community is unbound, man. It's completely warranted in some cases. You know, some of these guys are really good, and some of them are not. And so when I sit back and think, wow, you know, we're automatically given a rubber stamp on what we expect from, Office of Special Investigation, like the FBI come in, you expect an FBI agent to be able to come in and give an unbiased, very, very thorough investigation and build their case based on evidence, as opposed to stepping in, not conducting investigations well at all. People think that, and don't get me wrong, there are some homemakers out there that have sat in a house and raised children, been married, taking care of the house, cooked meals. And along the way, they watched a whole lot of TV shows. And in those TV shows, they picked up some pretty incredible skill sets on conducting an investigation. And so there's that. But what a lot of people that want to be an investigator don't understand is it's not just about who, what, when, where, why, and how this happened. There is a whole bunch more. That's a basic interview process. That's not a cross examination. That's not an interrogation. It's not a regressive forensic interview. It's not, there's so many different levels and so many different other ways to speak with somebody and get their information, not just trying to prove them correct or not, or trying to prove whether they're truthful or not, but actually trying to follow the story and try to follow the line of thinking for that person. Because especially in this one, I mean, it was the newest witness that would have been brought out would have been the original witness, which would have been Major Jesse Marcel. And he was contacted by Stanton Freeman, who, like I said before, is an amazing guy. I love Stanton a lot. As a nuclear physicist, as a professional researcher, he had a set of skills. However, there were some other skills that would have really been helpful in his interview process in order to do this. So when you're talking to Jesse Marcel and you're working off of 30 plus years of memories, some suppressed, some overt, some, that are fill in the blank. And he's just trying to kind of make sense of what happened. over that amount of time. It would have been very helpful. And a lot of this stuff also is new. You know, forensic statement analysis, what I used in looking at Trukowski's and some of the other people that they actually interviewed. And I go in and use a forensic statement analysis process in order to identify the weaknesses in their questions, the leading questions, the coaching, the overt manipulation that they used on these older gentlemen that they brought in to interview was crazy. And I keep using that word because I sit back and look at it now and just shake my head and go, wow. You know, this is so in your face now. In 1994, it wasn't so much because there wasn't that much research put into forensic statement analysis at that point. So yeah, it was a really interesting process going through this and trying to cut down the weeds and figure out what is really important in this investigation and what is just kind of smoke and mirrors.
So before we go into this after action report, basically, do you think it was a crashed disc that was piloted by aliens, or are you on the fence with that?
Wow, damn it. You could ask me that in the first 10 minutes. So I'm going to hope that it was something, you know, that's where I am. I want to believe. The problem is I'm an evidence guy. I'm a process guy. I was planning on becoming a psychologist. And after 4 years of school, I decided, you know what? I don't want to hear your problems anymore. So I have a background in not only how things should be, but how they actually are. And so the amount of physical evidence that we have would lead us to believe that it was not an extraterrestrial craft, because we have no physical evidence of that. We don't even have any physical evidence of the supposed mogul balloon that was recovered. And if there is physical evidence of that, it's probably at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, or it's being kept somewhere in some box, either intentionally or accidentally secret. They just can't find it. And that doesn't surprise me at all if they've packed the thing up and you know, some E2 enlisted, you know, some private is working as a personnel man or something in some big warehouse, and he puts it in the wrong place. It'd be real easy to do. So based on the physical evidence, no. Based on the circumstantial evidence that gives us a lot more credibility in the story, and I say that in when we look at all the circumstances that happened, the way everything was deployed, the way the military responded, that sort of thing. And then the back end, you know, after 30 plus years of it sitting cold, and all of a sudden Stan Freeman opening this can of worms up, you have, you know, over another additional 20 plus years, you have, you know, 700, 800, 900, however many people you want to count that either initially came forward based on the Unsolved Mysteries episode, or they heard somebody was looking for, you know, information, or they were contacted by one of the, you know, what I would consider initially as hobbyist investigators to try to find out some information. And so based on that, undoubtedly, there was an extraterrestrial craft that crashed in somewhere in New Mexico, in the desert north of Roswell, and somewhere south sort of Corona, just based on the amount of people that came forward. So it depends on, you know, when you go into a criminal case, it's in the United States, you have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt to convict somebody. And if it's a civil case, you have to have a preponderance of the evidence in order to render a judgment. So if this was a criminal case, we can get into that a little bit later as far as how they conducted their investigations, how the Air Force conducted their interviews. But based on a criminal case, you would have been what's called in the United States, no billed. You either get a true bill or a no bill out of a grand jury on whether or not a felony is going to proceed to court. So this would be no billed in a criminal case, just for the simple fact that the evidence isn't there. The physical evidence isn't there. The circumstantial evidence certainly is. So if you went before a court that held civil law, not criminal law, but civil law, it would have been adjudicated as true. So it just kind of depends on how you look at it, what you consider is more important.
Originally, the story came out in the Roswell Daily Record, and I think went round to other papers as well. And that was around July 8th and 9th, 1947. And then it just kind of disappeared. And there was 31 years where nobody ever talked about Roswell. Was there no mention of it at all in 31 years?
So, yes, there was. In little obscure little magazines and stuff like that, there were little snippets of, it just kind of suggested that something had happened out there, but they didn't go into it very in depth because, it was a different time in the 1940s, early 1950s, especially in the United States, and Britain was probably very similar, is we trusted our government and we trusted what they told us. And if they did lie to us, we didn't make a big deal about it because we knew that the reason that they did that was for our own good, you know, for national security. And we kind of shrugged our shoulders and went, yeah, you know, whatever. Do I have enough money in my bank account? Am I able to make my house payment? Is there food on the table? All right, let's move forward, you know? And so that changed quite a bit over the years. And, you know, we had the 60s upheavals in the 60s and 70s. And the generations changed. People's perceptions changed. We've changed so much since then to now, right? And so when you're looking at, whether anybody was really asking about it, they didn't care up until that point. And then, you know, a lot of what back then were called muckrakers, people who just stirred the muck, came, you know, more and more prevalent. And not that Stanton Friedman was a muckraker at all, but he was looking at something that didn't make sense to him. Then he heard some other things that, you know, were obviously intentionally hidden, and he wanted to find out about it. And it was a pretty pretty fantastic story. The whole thing, it remains a pretty fantastic story, whether it was a crashed spaceship from outer space or whether it was just a masterful manipulative plan to cover over whatever it is they're still covering. Because that's the crazy thing that I believe out of this whole thing is the United States Air Force is still lying to us about this. They are still manipulating and covering over some factual information. The problem is, I don't know what that factual information is. I just know how to, recognize a lie, and I don't do it intuitively. I do it based on a whole lot of psychological studies, a whole lot of FBI work, a whole lot of forensic examination work, and say, all of these things together indicate deception. They're still being deceptive to us.
So it was after like 31 years and it became known. Was it Stanton Friedman originally got in contact with Jesse Marcel? Is that how it started?
Yeah, that was in about 1978. Stanton had through different channels had heard that Jesse Marcel had spoken with some reporter types about this incident, and then Stan Freeman got in touch with Jesse Marcel, and then did the interview with him. And still, it took another almost, I don't know, what was it, 20 years or so before it was really mainstream and came out in Unsolved Mystery.
And there was a sighting, wasn't there? I made a note of it here. On the 2nd of July, approximately 10 p.m., was it Dan Wilmot reported seeing a glowing object?
That's right, yeah. So there were several different people. And once again, that's after the 89-90, whenever people watched it, and the Unsolved Mysteries episode. Dan Wilmot actually was in the newspaper back in 47, at the same time as this this came out, reporting that, he saw that glowing object in the sky, which makes his information much different than the information that happens after the Unsolved Mysteries episode. So there's several different little credible things that were happening around Roswell that came forward. But Dan Wilmot's, him and his wife sitting on the porch, is probably, if you looked at importance, he would probably be the most important involved person. And you can't really connect that directly to the Roswell crash. I use in air quotes. But is very circumstantial, right? Because when they found this thing, was just directly after that time, or when they at least brought it forward. Because there's that argument of whether Matt Brazel found it, several days before July 8th, or whether it was like June 14th, whether he found it then, or there were several weeks that is still a little hazy. Now, if you talk to, and you have talked to Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt and them, they can narrow it down much better. But once again, they're narrowing it down based on information that they get, 30, 40 years after the incident happened. And when you're talking that amount of days and you think you can narrow it down to 1 or 2 days, good luck with that. If it's not documented in a newspaper someplace, or, okay. If that's the day you say it happened, that's the day. All right. It's neither here nor there at this point.
So it was Mac Brazel who found this stuff on his ranch, or not. It's not his ranch, was it? He was the foreman of the ranch.
Right.
And then he took it to the police. Is that right? But what do you make of Mac Brazel? Because was there a thing where it was suggested he was like taken prisoner? I don't know if prisoner is the right word. The army took him and they kept him for a few days. And when he came out, his story changed.
Yeah. And once again, that information comes out 30 plus years later. Kind of the agreed upon, mostly agreed upon incident that happened was he found it. He found this debris. A few days go by and he goes back out and he collects it up, and then he takes it into see Sheriff Wilcox. Now, depends on what story you hear, because there's several different stories on it, but all of them are pretty much the same. The Proctors, who were a neighbor, there's stories that their son was with him when he was out riding his horse and looking for damage to fence lines in the area. And And then some stories are his son was with him. So there's it when it comes down to it, it really doesn't matter whether the proctor said, "Hey, you should take that to the police," because they were used to weather balloons coming down. A lot of different balloons would have tags on them, and some of them were useless, and some of them had equipment on them where you would get a reward if you turned it in. So there's the story that the proctor said, "Hey, you ought to go take that to the sheriff, and maybe there's a reward or something for it." So he brought some of that material to Sheriff Wilcox in Roswell, which is actually further away than Corona from the crash site. However, it had the Air Force base there, and everyone presumed that this material was probably the U.S. government. So anyway, he takes it to Sheriff Wilcox. Sheriff Wilcox looks at it and goes, "I don't know what that is, but it's obviously, military stuff. So let's contact the Roswell Army Airfield." And that's when Major Marcel gets assigned to follow up and meet with Mac Brazel and Sheriff Wilcox there at the sheriff's office. And they decide to go out to the location and see what they can find. So that's, once again, I'm really generalizing things because I have a huge amount of respect for a lot of the different investigators that have done a ton of work, have spent thousands and thousands of their own dollars to get this stuff done and try to figure this out. I can't choose one or the other for the simple fact that bottom line, it really doesn't matter why, what day, what material was brought or whatever. The fact that whatever happened started Jesse Marcel in his vehicle heading to the Foster Ranch. And that's all that really matters at that point.
Yeah. And you say in the book that Brazel had found weather balloons in the past. So he knew what they were. So it seems a bit odd that he'd find this stuff and not straight away know that it's a weather balloon and go to the police and get it checked out.
Yeah, a lot of people out there had found these different type things. And, you know, when you have Amagordo, you have nuclear test proving grounds in the area, you have all kinds of people that are involved in doing that stuff, and nobody's talking to one another because it's all pretty much secret. And everybody's working on a different facet of a particular idea and trying to support, you know, the general policy of whatever the military or government has chosen to go with. You know, everybody's using different material, different things, or they're trying out different things. So it would make sense. It would make complete sense that this material could be something unusual. And also, you know, it could be just, I can't get the material I need, so I'm going to use something from the local store. And you go and you buy just like anybody else, the material that you need. And it's real, it's kind of interesting because I've seen a lot of, I've read a lot of, different, magazine articles and books and stuff like that, where they're talking about, you know, the government would not have done that. They have their own material. They do this, they do that. I'm like, okay, that's not true at all. I was in the Navy during Desert Storm, and we fabricated all kinds of stuff. So if we don't have the material that on board, you know, we go to a tender ship, a ship that's designed to fix other ships, go contact them. If they don't have the material on board, you outsource it. You go to whatever closest country is that's friendly to us, that we have already like basically open purchase agreements with, and you locate the stuff that way, and you obtain it that way. So it wouldn't be anything unusual to have a weather balloon or that type of equipment land on your property. it wouldn't be unusual to find it. And it wouldn't be unusual that it would be something that might not be normal, if that makes sense.
I wanted to talk about Jesse Marcel, but first of all, just before, he was one of the military personnel on the Roswell Army Airfield, and that was the only base at the time that had the atomic bomb. So arguably the most powerful military base on the planet. So there's this idea I've heard that perhaps the personnel on that base, because it was such an important base, everyone was handpicked. It was the best of the best. But do you think there was just normal assignments?
It's right after World War II, and they've just released a whole lot of people out of the military. There's a whole lot of people in the military that wanted to get the hell out of there, right? They've fought their battles. They've been deployed. They've made their sacrifice, and they're ready to go. In theory, you would think that, you know, this is the only nuclear capable bomb wing in the world. And we're going to pick the best of the best, and they're going to go there. Well, I know that that's not how assignments are necessarily made. You might be able to go in and, you know a guy that is really good and contact his general and get him to release and maybe transfer this and that. But with the turmoil that was happening after World War II, with the amount of people leaving, the amount of reassignments, and all of the other stuff that was going on in the war, I'm gonna use a little bit of an analogy here on this. Let's say you are a general in the Air Force, and you have a bunch of people sending you letters saying, "There's a flying saucer that crashed out here. We want to know the truth. We want to know the truth. We want to know the truth." And you have a bunch of spies that are trying to infiltrate your government. You have criminals that are attacking your embassies. You have all kinds of people deployed overseas investigating espionage and that sort of thing. Who are you going to put in charge of the UFO? Is it going to be the best guy? I'm just saying, I'm posing the question that, if it's 1947 and you have the Nuremberg trials going on, you have the trials that's going on over in Asia, the trials that were going on in Japan were nothing like the Nuremberg trials. They were not being conducted by a central group. They were being conducted by hundreds of people, and they were just basically hunting down officers of the Japanese army and military and just killing them. There wasn't much of a trial at all. So you had all that. You had all the black market stuff that was going on. So all of the people that were investigating things, the intelligence officers, the counterintelligence officers, were very, very busy overseas. And then you had this hotspot in Roswell where we have nuclear weapons. So to say that they were picking all the best people and putting them there is absolutely not true. Did they pick some of the best people? Sure. But like I said before, I can sit and stand on the backs of these great men and tell them what they should have done and what they didn't do and all this other stuff. We can do that to each other. I can find the best homicide detective I've ever worked with. I can look into his reports and I can find misspellings and poor grammar and things that he should have said and didn't say and things that he should have added in there from a transcript that he didn't do. We can second guess ourselves all day long. They were not the best of the best. They were a bunch of good guys, and they were not hand selected. They were assigned there based on their on their classification clearances and that sort of stuff. I'm not saying that it didn't happen. I'm not saying that Colonel Blanchard didn't say, you know what, I worked with Walter Hott over in the Pacific. We did the Bikini Atoll, testing, and I want him as my PIO. I want him as my public information officer. I'm not saying that didn't happen. I'm just saying that not everybody was hand selected. It was a process of a whole bunch of stuff. And that's the sad thing about doing any of this stuff. Yeah, I've had people say, "Oh my God, Greg, you're really going to write a book about Roswell? Do you know what's going to happen to you when you do that? You're going to have people attacking you from every side." And I'm like, "Yeah, well, that's part of it. I understand that." And when you're looking at what happened at Roswell and the individuals, you pull up people like Jesse Marcel. And initially, he's the major of the only nuclear capable bomber wing in the world at that time. He had, you know, above top secret security clearance. He's the intelligence officer for this whole thing, for Christ's sake. Then you look into his background. You go, "Wow, this doesn't really match everything that I was expecting." And it's sad because we all have things in our past that is not perfect. And so in his case, he had, you know, I don't know, 100 individual people looking into his background and, you know, what he said, what he did, where he trained, how much education he has, all this stuff. And all of a sudden start just whittling away at him, and assuming that you whittle away at the man, it whittles away at his credibility and it whittles away at the incident that he's describing. And those two things can be, you know, mutually exclusive. Just because someone is diagnosed a schizophrenic and he comes to you and says, "I was abducted by aliens," doesn't mean he wasn't abducted by aliens because he's a schizophrenic. It means that he could have had an experience that he thought he was abducted by aliens, or he was abducted by aliens, and they're mutually exclusive of each other. You have to do the investigation to try to figure out whether or not, you know, he was where he said he was when he said the incident happened and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. But a lot of investigators, a lot of debunkers, people who just go into this thing not following the evidence, not following the testimony of a lot of experiencers, they just go, "That didn't happen," and they go in and try to debunk everything. And that's what happened to a lot of these guys that had come forward. You know, they just got torn up. And Jesse Marcel was one of them that they really went after to discredit him.
So there's the story that Jesse Marcel then collected a load of debris from this ranch, and he was on his way back to the base, and he went home and he showed it to his son and his wife. And you met his son, Jesse Marcel Jr., several times. Does he seem like a genuine guy to you?
Oh, super nice guy. Great guy. Medical doctor, flight surgeon in the military. He got recalled for a Desert Storm, and he was long in the tooth then. And he was just a nice guy. You know, every time I talked to him, he never said that his dad recovered a flying saucer. That never came up. he indicated that his father found something special, something very unusual that he believed was not created on Earth, you know, it was created someplace else. And, you know, that's the funny thing about, like, both of it, him and his father. All Jesse Marcel would have had to have said is they recovered a flying spaceship, and I don't know what happened to it. They took it someplace. I guess it went to Wright Pad. It went to DC. It went someplace. I don't know what happened. And put the whole thing in there. Yeah, there was alien, you know, equipment. There was all this stuff. Jesse Marcel never said anything about that. He said that he, you know, collected some debris that he couldn't identify, and he didn't believe it was of this earth. And Jesse Marcel Jr., his son, sitting or was asleep at home, and his dad comes home and wakes him up and says, "Hey, come in here. This is really something special. I want to show you this." Now, the crazy part about that is, you have the debunkers that will go in and say, "Really? Okay, so these guys are the best of the best, the highest credible, you know, just incredible guys. They're top secret security clearance. And this knucklehead takes a bunch of space debris and takes it home and exposes his wife and his son to it." It's like, who would do that? You know, who would bring this stuff home if it's that big of a secret and it's from outer space, and let your son, you know, pick it up and look at it and stuff? That's crazy. That's contemporary thinking. At that same time, they had airmen standing out in the middle of the desert and letting bombs explode 40,000 feet over their head to see what it was like. You know, all those guys got cancer. That's not what Jesse Marcel was thinking, that this stuff could have could have radiation coming off of it. He found this very special stuff, couldn't identify it, didn't know what it was, and brought it home to share with his son and have a moment with his son and go, "Look at this. This is something incredible. This changes the whole world. I want you to remember this. You know, I want you to see this. I want to be a part of our history." That's why he did it. We wouldn't do that today because we wouldn't know what kind of alien debris, you know, microbes, bacteria, radiation, whatever, could expose our family to that. This was pre-TV. You know, Jesse Marcel wasn't watching Outer Limits. Outer Limits happened way after that. Jesse Marcel didn't watch the moon landing because it happened way after that. So he's working on 1947 technology, and so he brings it home. Yeah, it makes no sense. If it's that secret, why would he do that? If he had that much integrity to have this huge, you know, over top secret security clearance, why would he take it home and expose his family to not only a pathogen, radiation, but also to the knowledge that, maybe there's Soviet operatives that were working, Russian operatives that were working in Roswell. I'm sure there were trying to gather up information. Why would you expose your family to a piece of intelligence that, foreign operatives might be after? But he did. And he didn't deny that at all. He said it happened.
Jesse Marcel never changed the story, did he? He never exaggerated or added anything.
No. And, the Air Force, when they came in and did their investigation in 94, 95, they talked a lot about memory. They talked a lot about how malleable memory is and how memories can change over time. And then you had a lot of the Roswell investigators who, at this point in 94, had become pretty good investigators. They still didn't have any formalized training in cross-examination or forensic examination or anything like that, which that's what you would do if you were a cold case detective. And this is a cold case. So they were investigating a case that they didn't understand the methods in order to do that. And you're looking at that sort of thing, and the Air Force saying that memories can change, and these hobbyist investigators, or at this point, fairly professional reportive investigators, saying, "No, it doesn't. No, I remember stuff when I was a kid, and that's exactly the way it happened, and my memory doesn't change." Well, there's way too many studies out there that say memory does change. And I'll give my own example of that. when I was in high school, I had a very close friend of mine. We did a lot of stuff together. We were together all the time. And this person had a red Cutlass, Oldsmobile Cutlass. Really cool car, fast, big engine. I can see it right now. Red, kind of a maroon red with a white vinyl top. And we did everything. We went all over the place, did all this stuff. Probably 10 years ago, I was talking to this person and talking about the red Cutlass. And the person said, no, it was blue. And I was like, what? No, it wasn't. It was red. I never owned a red Cutlass. It was blue. And they showed me a picture of it. And it was a blue Cutlass. In my head, to this day, it is a red Cutlass. It is a maroon Cutlass. So I know for a fact that your brain can play tricks on you, not intentionally, but whenever there's holes in your memory, our brains naturally try to figure out what was in that hole and will make sense of something and just put it in there. And there's too many psychologists and psychiatrists out there that will support what I just said to even have the debate, because the people that say that doesn't happen are not psychologists, they're not sociologists, they're not, you know. So it's very important that we remember those kinds of things, and that we are flawed. And that's why it's so important that we write these things down, that we do reports and document what we do, which unfortunately was not done by the United States Army Air Corps or the Army or the United States Air Forces in this manner, in this matter. They didn't do it. And so that was one of the things that is so. They made a big deal about when they sent Jesse Marcel out. He was the intelligence officer, which would make sense. If there's something strange out there, you send the intelligence officer out there to look at it. They also sent a counterintelligence officer out there. And for those of you who are listening and don't understand or don't know what a counterintelligence officer is, a counterintelligence officer twists all the truth up to make it sound like it makes sense, so that they cover over what really happened. So people say, well, I find it very unusual that they would send a counterintelligence officer out there. Well, I don't, for the simple fact that you have all of these secrets that you're trying to keep secret, and you don't know what's crashed out there. We have some debris. Let's go take a look at it. And this could be something secret. So we're going to need to cover it up to begin with. So they were setting themselves up to cover this up to begin with. And that's the crazy thing about Sheridan Cavett. He was the captain that went with Major Jesse Marcel out to the ranch. Captain Sheridan Cavett was a counterintelligence officer. And the funny thing is he stuck to his story to his death. It was nothing. It was a weather balloon. That was it. Even after he was instructed that it was a Mogul balloon, he still stuck with his story. And I find that highly amusing.
Okay. So Jesse Marcel took this stuff back to Roswell Army Airfield, and they put out that famous news report they'd sent to the paper where they said they'd captured a disc, and the paper changed it to got a flying saucer. They didn't say disc, they said flying saucer, and they changed it a little bit.
Right. Well, and they collected a disc, and the newspaper says captured flying saucer, because yeah, that sounds a lot better than collected up some debris. It's fantastic.
And then the next day it was changed, and Jesse Marcel was pictured with some weather balloon wreckage in General Ramey's office. But the question there is, why would they put out that report that they'd captured a disc when it was actually a weather balloon? It's suggesting that the people at Roswell Army Airfield can't tell the difference between a disc and a weather balloon. And they must see weather balloons all the time. The Air Force must have been putting them up often.
Yeah, crazy, right? So to kind of put this in a nutshell, the Air Force, the Army Air Forces, you know, they're in flux at that point. It was the Army Air Corps, then the Army Air Forces, and it became the Air Force. So all of this, from like 1944 or so, to 1947, this organization is in flux. Everything is moving. Policies are being changed. All kinds of stuff is going on. And you have this basic incident that happens. The intelligence and counterintelligence officer goes out to this ranch that a rancher reports some debris. They collect the debris. They bring it back. They presumably look at the debris. And then the commander of the base, Colonel Blanchard, presumably approves a press release, because obviously, you know, the sheriff already knows about it. And the one of the radio stations already knows about it. The paper already knows about it, because they contact the sheriff once a day, you know, to find out who's been arrested, anything going on, that sort of thing. So the Air Force at this point, I'm using, you know, the Army Air Forces. The Roswell Airfield then says, well, we need to do a press release to get in front of this thing. And that's where you go, what? So Colonel Blanchard approved, you presume that he approves this press release, because back then, anything coming out of there is going to have to be approved by that level of clearance from the commanding officer. Today, not necessarily. Today, a lot of times, public information officers are given the authority because they are presumed to be the expert in this, and they will have kind of a little bit of autonomy to release certain things, certain information, right? Back then, absolutely not. No. So we would have to assume that Colonel Blanchard said, yes, release that press, or make that press release. And so Walter Haught, who's a lieutenant, writes up this press release, and talk about, you know, collecting a disc, bringing it back. And they have the disc in their possession, which when you say that, it sounds like it's in one piece, right? When you say I have a disc, it's in one piece. If it was in 400 pieces, I would say I have this debris of what I presume, or what I assume is a disc, right? And that's what, something that really threw me off when I'm sitting there reading the real stuff from the time that it happened, and you say, I collected a disc. You collected a disc. You didn't collect balsa wood sticks, tape, aluminum foil. You collected a disc, my friend. That's what you said. You're a colonel in the United States Air Force. You collected a disc. And then you send that over to the Roswell Daily Record newspaper. And they look at it and go, that doesn't sound cool enough. Let's say captured a flying saucer in Roswell region. That will sell papers. Bam. And so they do that. And that happens today, right? With all the protests that we had in 2020, much of it was fueled based on really poor reporting and exaggeration on what was actually happening. And it's fueling all that because it sells papers, it sells advertising, it sells all that. So, you know, newspapers have been doing this stuff forever. So they did that. And I'm gonna pose a question to you again. I did this to you earlier, and I didn't allow you to answer, because I guess it's there's no real answer to it. But I pose the question to the listeners. You're a 4-star general in the United States Air Force. And one of your colonels, somebody who's four steps below you, releases a press release that says, "We captured a flying saucer in Roswell region." And you go in and you find out it's a weather balloon. What do you do to that colonel? You fire him, right? You send him to Antarctica to overlook logistics in Antarctica. You don't let him, you know, his fit rep, his report, his annual appraisal is crap at this point, and you're never going to be in charge of anything ever again. You fire that guy. Well, just so you know, Colonel Blanchard in the next 10 years is promoted one step away from the Joint Chiefs. He's three steps away from being the president in the military level of operations. That's how high that guy got. How did that happen? How did he run this debacle of a weather balloon turning into a spaceship, turning back into a weather balloon, and get promoted that high? That guy, whatever he did in Roswell was awesome. Whatever he did was incredible. What he orchestrated there was just something fantastic.
The book we've been talking about is called Roswell, the After Action Report, and that's on Kindle, and it's paperback, and getting it on Amazon. Is it available lots of other places?
It is. You can get it on my website also, theparanormaldetective.com or authorgreglawson.com.
That's great. Well, thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast. It's been really good talking to you.
Had fun, man. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
And that was an interview with Greg Lawson about his book, Roswell, the After Action Report. My book, Aspects of Alien Abduction, Shocking UFO Encounters, Volume 1, is now on sale. For decades, people around the world have described encounters with non-human beings that seem impossible to explain. In this book, I explore these accounts through the voices of those who say they experience them firsthand. And what emerges is deeply unsettling. The same patterns appear again and again. Mysterious visitors, medical procedures, hybrid programs, and encounters that challenge our understanding of consciousness itself. This suggests a complex strategy being operated by non-human intelligence. It is highly organized, skillfully implemented, and affecting many people worldwide. Aspects of Alien Abduction invites you to consider one of the most profound mysteries of our time. Available now on audiobook, paperback, and Kindle. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.